Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect is Madeline Philbin. Madeline is a supervisor, executive director for the Midwest region of the Catholic Relief Services. It's a worldwide organization. And we'll be talking to her about her organization and about herself. Madeline Philbin, With Respect. Madeline, how are you doing?
Great. Glad to be with you.
Glad to have you. Madeline, tell me, all right, where are you from originally?
I'm originally from the Chicago area, actually from Oak Park, which is a suburb just to the west. My parents or grandparents grew up in Chicago. And my
What part of the city?
They grew up on the west side, so in the Austin neighborhood.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
Lawndale neighborhood. And their parents before them, we were part of the famine Irish, mostly, that came to Chicago.
What county?
So my father's side is County Mayo. My mother is County Limerick.
Ah, okay.
Up to some German and English blood in there, too. And actually, my German relatives were living in northwest Indiana. So.
Okay. Well, my ancestors are half Polish, or they're Polish on one side and Irish on the other, and it's County Cavan for the Irish folks. At any rate... this is very difficult for me to ask you this. Are you a White Sox fan or a Cubs fan? This is very important.
You know, I'm a Cubs fan, and I've inherited that trait. I have to say my dad and my uncle were at the last World Series.
Ooh.
My grandparents were at the World Series in, I think, 29 or something like that. So, yeah, I pretty much got to be loyal to the
Cubs. All right. That's fair. You come by it honestly.
Yep.
I'll accept that. So how did you get started in – where did you start in school? Where were you at? Oak Park?
I went to Catholic school in Oak Park, the parish school and the Catholic high school, and then I graduated from University of Notre Dame.
Mm-hmm. What was your degree in?
My degree was history.
Okay.
So then I tell people now I make history.
What area did you specialize in history?
Well, you know, really as an undergraduate – You have everything to learn. So
yeah.
We didn't choose a particular region of the world. It was sort of a learning a little bit about the history of everywhere.
Yeah. So what happened after college?
While I was in college, actually, I worked for Catholic Charities of Chicago. And while I was there, I became more aware of a profession that I wouldn't have known by this title, which was being a community organizer.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I moved from Catholic Charities, which was a little bit more of a direct service, to working as a community organizer for different neighborhood groups in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
which is more about helping people to organize to change the circumstances of their lives. And kind of from that career path eventually brought me to where I am now with Catholic Relief Services.
Well, but why? All right, you're a history major. Why community organizing? I mean, I don't see the connection there.
Well, I think as a history major, in a way, it was a kind of a major where you could study everything. And mm-hmm. so it wasn't necessarily that I suppose people who are history majors are planning to be teachers of history, but there wasn't a direct career path that exactly every history major takes. So I knew I was interested in, you know, service, kind of changing the world, not anything mm-hmm. that fell in that general category. And so being a history major seemed like a good foundation for that.
But so you actually thought about this service before you went in, or at least while you were in college. So this is not something that came about afterwards.
Right. I did. I think when I was growing up, my father worked for the Archdiocese of Chicago. My parents were very much the sort of Catholic social justice tradition, and mm-hmm. You know, that I grew up around that, and so that was
Monsignor Egan was a
Monsignor Egan was in our home often, and yes,
he was a famous for those who don't remember or have heard of Monsignor Egan. He was a Catholic priest who back in the 40s, 50s, 60s was one of the pioneers in that area of Chicago of social justice programs and movements.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a very famous guy. So what was he like? I've never met anybody who knows him, and I've always heard about this guy.
You know, he was, you know, my parents' whole set of friends, and my parents are 87 and still living in the house we grew up in. They had a set of friends in particular they spent New Year's Eve with. So we as kids would enjoy that, you know, spying from the other room. And you know, as we say goodbye to them one by one, you know, one of their sons was, a friend of my parents passed away recently. His son was giving the eulogy, and he said, "I don't know one of us who are the children of this group that don't envy their friendships. They just had this wonderful network of people who cared deeply about their faith, were really engaged in the world and trying to change the world, and were funny and witty and smart, and managed to be, you know, spend time together socially in one another's homes while they were raising these huge families." So,
how large was your family?
I have three brothers and three sisters.
All right, so that's fine.
We were a small family in my neighborhood.
My parents had just the two of us, but each of those, their families were, one was 8 and the other was 5, and I think before that it was 13, and so we're kind of in a descending pyramid here in this generation. So what was your first job was with Catholic Charities?
My first job was with Catholic Charities. I started working there when I was in college, so I was the sort of, well, like you are as a college student, whatever it is they ask you to do, that's pretty much what you're doing. But when I graduated, I worked as what was called an educational counselor. And it was mostly working with people who, at that point, who dropped out of high school. And I think it was a little bit of that, where you see a different person every day, but you're seeing the same problem. Well, different person, same problem. And that made me interested in what is one thinks of more as community organizing, which is, can we do something about the problem, while recognizing there's a value and a need to working with each individual who's living with the problem. Gee, wouldn't it be great if we could do something to prevent the problem from happening? And that was when I switched a little bit to having my work more focused that way.
So, you know, one of the things that I've found working with people is that, you know, I started off as an assistant prosecutor here in Berrien County, and as my audience knows, in the seminary before that. But I've always been interested in people. And one of the things is, the more you learn about people is you learn that the stereotypes that you bring into your life when you first get out into the big world are not how it always plays out. I mean, you change. You begin to see people as they really exist, as opposed to some theory. Did you go through that? How did you view that? Did you have the perfect vision of all people before you started?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think certainly as I've worked, you know, over the years, I keep working with more and more communities that aren't the communities I grew up with. So you know, you grow up in Grove Park, and I grew up in an Irish Catholic world, and then I meet new folks, and so. And you learn about people as you meet them, but I don't think there's anything that's startling to me about you know, what I've learned. Some of the folks I grew up with were asking me recently, since for Catholic Relief Services, I've had a chance to travel in Pakistan and Nepal and Ethiopia and Uganda and Nicaragua. And these are people I've known since kindergarten. They kind of said, so what did you learn? What can you tell us? And I said, you know, it sounds really corny, but I really learned or been reminded that people are pretty much the same everywhere in terms of, you know, what they want and good life for their kids and the opportunity to take care of them and give them a chance to become more educated probably than they were, you know, and food and shelter and the opportunity to have work that's meaningful. And I guess I haven't experienced anything that's changed my view on that.
So you basically expanded the same thing. That is, people are the same. People are, in their basics, they're the same the world around.
Mm-hmm.
What then did you do when you started working with Catholic Relief Services? What was that? What is Catholic Relief Services?
Catholic Relief Services, you know, some people are familiar with Catholic Charities. Maybe that's a starting point, which works here in the U.S. in a local community to help people get out of poverty and improve their lives. Catholic Relief Services is really the sister organization, which is the U.S. Catholic Church and people of goodwill in the U.S. who support Catholic Relief Services acting overseas, acting around the world in Latin America, Africa, Asia. Always partnering with the local community, so we don't ever come in as Americans and set up shop and say, hey, we're running a program and we decided what you need, but we're always invited into a country. We're working in partnership with whomever has invited us in, usually the local Catholic Church, but not necessarily. And we help to build the capacity of the institutions in that country to solve the problems of folks living there.
So how does that differ from other relief organizations? I mean, I like everybody else, I get tons and tons of advertisements for various organizations that are promising me that they'll take my money and they'll do wonderful things with it, and they'll send me a picture of the child or the adult who I'm supporting.
Mm-hmm.
How do they differ from one another, or do they? Are they all the same?
Well, I can speak to Catholic Relief Services and maybe say a couple things about other organizations. I mean, there are a lot of good and honorable organizations working overseas, and often overseas we work together, which when I first learned that when I was working for Catholic Relief Services, that was sort of reassuring and good to hear that, you know, that while it may seem like we're competing with each other because there's eight letters in your mailbox, when you're actually overseas, the different organizations really collaborate in terms of somebody might be working on water sanitation and someone else on food distribution and try to learn from each other. But Catholic Relief Services, in particular, the principles of partnership that I mentioned before are essential to the identity of CRS. So we're always, again, we're coming in there as a partner. We're also there for the long haul. So often folks turn to Catholic Relief Services to respond to emergencies. Haiti would be an example, but elsewhere too. And it's because we're already in the country. And so sometimes CRS is the best group to go to because you don't need to spend time kind of starting up and getting running. You know, in the example of Haiti, we're already there. We already have staff. We already have vehicles. We already have warehouses. And so we're often better positioned to respond right at the moment when there's a disaster. But the other difference, and Haiti again would be an example, is we're also there for the long haul. So we're not just about responding to the emergency in the moment, but we're really about development over time. And the other thing that's become essential to what CRS is about, which wasn't necessarily true when we began 60 years ago, but is essential to us now, is that we're always about peace building. Wherever we are, we're always, you know, whether it's something as basic as food distribution, we're saying, how is this contributing to peace? How is this contributing to peace and justice in the country? And that's part of what Catholic Relief Services is.
Well, by its definition, by the name itself, it's Catholic. And that brings to mind, well, do you evangelize with the people that you're helping? Or is this a way of getting more Catholics in the world?
We we do the work that we do at Catholic Relief Services because our faith calls us to do this work. It's we do it because we're Catholic, not because they're Catholic. So it's not about as the expression goes, it's about need, not creed. We're not serving people. We're not looking for Catholics to serve, nor are we looking to convert people to Catholicism or Christianity or anything. We're there as our faith calls us to be, to respond to the needs of the poor and vulnerable around the world.
How does that go over in countries where the population is not Catholic or maybe has never had a good feeling for the Catholic Church? How does that work out?
It's interesting. In fact, most of the countries where we work, and we're in 100 countries, and we work with the poorest of the poor, and that's part of our special calling too, the majority of them are not Catholic. They're not Christian. And in fact, the majority of our staff working around the world are not Catholic and are not Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Our staff are mostly people from the countries where we are working. So in fact, most of our staff are of Muslim faith.
Wait a minute. Most of your staff is Muslim?
Most of our staff, if we're working in Ethiopia or mm-hmm. Uganda or Haiti or Pakistan, most of our staff are from the countries where we work. And so that means most of them are not Catholic, as mm-hmm. I said. Yeah, most okay. of them are Muslim.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Madeline Philbin of the Catholic Relief Services. We're talking about how she got into it, but also what is giving about, what is service about, and what does her organization do that is distinctive. We'll be right back. We're back now with Madeline Philbin, Executive Director for the Midwest Region of Catholic Relief Services. Madeline, when we took our break, you just began to talk about the fact that the places that you go, that you're in 100 countries around the world, is that full-time? That is, you have full-time people there in those countries all the time. Is that what you're telling me?
Some of those countries were supporting programs that an organization in the country, perhaps an international organization that's called Caritas, might be operating in that country, so we support them. South America is an example. We might have our office in Bolivia, but then support programs in other countries as well.
Where did Catholic Relief Services come from?
Catholic Relief Services started at the end of the Second World War. And it started with the U.S. Catholic Church, the U.S. bishops wanting to respond to the needs in Europe at the end of the Second World War and their recovery from the war. And so it was really about relief, and in that sense, you could say kind of emergency response. Over time, the organization started working in other parts of the world, but we also came to be about, you could say by the 70s, we're an organization that was not only about relief in the sense that, we think of emergency relief, but was also about development. In a way, if you want to use that familiar thought of, give a man a fish and teach a man a fish, mm-hmm. we'd gone from being about, yes, sometimes you need to roll up your sleeves and just give someone what they need, but mostly we want to be about teaching people to feed themselves. So it might be working on introducing different agricultural practices that was going to yield more and help folks be able to take care of their own communities, or introducing water and sanitation practices, or helping with health programs that were going to help a community to lead healthier lives. So it was really much more about development. So we became an organization that was relief and development by, say, the 70s. By about the 90s, we really went through an experience that again changed Catholic Relief Services, as it did many of us, which was the experience of having worked in Rwanda for so many years and then experiencing the genocide in Rwanda. And of course, I wasn't working for Catholic Relief Services then, but I've heard my colleagues talk about this. And we lost staff people lost family members. And this was a place where we had been working for years and years. And as one of my colleagues put it to me. He said, you know, you only had been in the country 2 weeks, and you could feel the tension that was going on between these two groups. But we always thought, well, that doesn't have anything to do with us. You know, we're about teaching people how to plant food, and we're not about...
Let me just stop you for a second. Many people, most of our audience will know about Rwanda, but tell us, for those who don't, what was the conflict? It was the Tutsis and the Hutus, who were two different tribes, and tribes in the sense that they were ethnic groups within the country of Rwanda. Where's Rwanda located?
It's in sort of central eastern Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you described, it was a conflict between the two groups in the country.
Long-standing tensions between these two tribes, these two groups.
And the conflict resulted in, you know, not only violence and hostility toward one another, such as you might see, or as unfortunately we have seen in different parts of the world, but actually accelerated where one side was wanting to completely destroy the other people. What we refer to now as genocide, when you're trying to, mm-hmm. when a state is really just trying to destroy a people. And during a relatively short period of time, you know, weeks, we're talking like 6 weeks, 10 weeks, I don't remember exactly, you know, 800,000 people were killed, you know, neighbors attacking neighbors. It just sort of this spasm of violence.
But this was prepared for substantially in advance of when it actually broke out, wasn't it?
One of the things that we, you know, when we look back and say, what can we learn from this? Your question really invites us to think about, which is, what were the signs that were happening as this, what we now know, was approached? You know, what was going on? Did we notice these things? Could we have done something about them? It's part of the reason, for example, why Catholic Relief Services and other organizations as well are very engaged now in when other countries' conflict begins to accelerate, because we say, hey, we said never again, and we were going to learn from the experience in Rwanda.
Yeah.
And so we certainly try to be, you know, that was where the shift, where we said we have to be about peace building. And so while we might be about teaching agricultural practices, we have to say, how does introducing this crop contribute to right relationships, contribute to people working together? You know, one of the bits of soul searching we had to do is say, were we contributing in any way to the tension between these two groups? Did we tend to work with one group more than the other, or contributed to resentment? And so became much more conscious about how every one of our actions can be contributing to peace and justice or contributing to tension. And let's make sure we're always acting in a way that we're contributing to peace and justice in a country.
Well, even today as we're talking, there are parts of Africa and parts of the rest of the world in which there are religious tensions which have blossomed, corrupted into violence between the two religious factions. I think of one country whose name is escaping me right this minute, unfortunately, where Catholics and Muslims in a particular province are just after each other and killing each other. And it's gangs and moving around and taking vengeance on one another for perceived or real wrongs. And so was this between the Tutsis and the Hutus, was that religious-based or ethnic or what?
No, it wasn't religious-based. And again, I'm giving a real, you know, general sense of it, mm-hmm. from what I've learned from others, but... you know, traditionally, again, to make it very simple, in some ways, one group had more the tradition, if we relate it to our own history, of the farmer versus the rancher. You know, there was, mm-hmm. a conflict in it in two different ways of life and how land was used. And that had been worked out, and sometimes the conflict was harsher, and sometimes folks were living together, you know, peacefully, again, if you use this sort of an oversimplified image of the farmer and the rancher,
mm-hmm.
but that in the latter part of the 20th century, things had happened to where benefits were accruing to one group more so than another, and then that started to contribute to division, mm-hmm. and tension, and that was part of the path that led to what we all saw happen, genocide.
And not only Catholic Relief Services, but other agencies and groups had been working in Rwanda leading up to that time. Mm-hmm. And I guess what you're saying is that everybody, at the end of the day, sat back and said, whoa, this is something that we were not prepared for. Why weren't we prepared for it? Why didn't we see it happening? So now that's where I interrupted you to lay the foundation. Tell us some more
and
about that.
And that is. And that's, I guess, why I cite my colleague, or it struck me, my colleague who said that about you only had to be there 2 weeks to feel the tension. So it wouldn't be accurate, again, from what I've heard, to say that we didn't notice, because at some level they did. It was more we didn't connect
the dots.
That, yes, you know, if we're part of being a partner with groups in this country, what role are we playing? And so since then, CRS has had not only relief, emergency relief and development, but has had peace building as an essential part of what we do. And that can mean different things in different parts of the world. So it may be that we're working with, often in the countries that we're working in, the local bishops in some ways serve as helping to resolve local conflicts. And so we work with them to get training for their staff or their teams of people to have sort of peace and justice committees that just solve neighborhood disputes the way we might think of a small claims court or something does. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, solving peace building, just, you know, peace building at home. How does it begin that way? I've seen when I've had a chance to visit our programs in Uganda, where there had been a longstanding war and many children had been abducted and become soldiers and eventually were released back into their communities. Circumstances enabled them to, as adults, to come back to their home communities, but their whole childhood had been as soldiers. So then how do you resolve conflict in your family if all you've learned is what you learned as a soldier? Mm-hmm. So one of the things we'll work with groups is what we would call here is domestic violence or family violence. You know, how do we instead work with the local church who's working with their own communities to introduce other ways of solving problems within the family or the community that doesn't involve violence? So some of the peace building we do is just at a very, you know, a very local level of just how do you help communities to work with one another.
One of the things that I want to draw a parallel to is when you're talking about in Uganda, and this was not only in Uganda but around Africa and perhaps elsewhere in the world, but I know it's been highlighted in Africa, and that is where these children, and that we're talking real children, we're not talking 15-year-olds, we're talking 11, 10, mm-hmm. 8-year-old kids mm-hmm. who were kidnapped by the various militant groups and forced to kill. Forced to become soldiers. And so they had these kids who, when other kids around the world and maybe around in the United States for the most part were playing baseball or playing soccer or whatever, these kids, men and boys and girls, were killing with machine guns. And now, is there not a parallel to what we see in some of the urban gangs in the United States, where young people are co-opted into gangs, and you can name them. In Chicago, there are gangs. In every major city, they have gangs, in which part of the way of perpetuating the gang is to bring in the young. I mean, is there a parallel? Because you've seen this, mm-hmm. from, say, in the city of Chicago. Mm-hmm. Can you draw a parallel? And I don't want to extend it too far, but is there not a parallel?
You know, I did have a chance to see, and just to say a little bit about that, I did travel to Uganda, and I did see some of these children. And what was happening is children were living in their homes with their families in these villages. So you kind of picture the small, kind of round hut home in a African village like we might have seen. And at night, they were being abducted. They were being kidnapped. And so the children themselves started to realize that they were safer if they stayed in town and stayed together. So they started, instead of sleeping in their various homes throughout the countryside, they'd come to the center of the village. They'd sleep together on the main street. And then in this particular part of Uganda, the bishop started to sleep on the street with them. And that was something that really, that gesture of solidarity really with the most vulnerable, I mean, the way we treat our children and what we allow them to experience, I guess, is a real measure of who we are. So having the bishop start to sleep on the street with them, to some degree, mobilized a lot of different communities, including Catholic Relief Services. And we didn't solve the problem by any means of the children being abducted, but we created a safe environment for them by building a shelter where they could sleep at night. And then the Irish Catholic Church, as it happened, contributed money to build a library. And so by the time I visited there, I was there at night, about 9 o'clock at night. That was when the kids started arriving to this place that had a shelter where they could sleep, and it had the library, and there was a little bit of a center. They went to different rooms where they kind of grabbed a rug and slept on the ground, and there was an odd kind of joyful sense of community there, even though there are extraordinary circumstances. You know, that is distinctly different from what I've seen, or the extent that I've experienced. For example, you talk about gangs and the circumstances that where children end up in gangs in the city, you know, the sense of alienation or isolation that leads them on that path. And so, you know, I think that the idea that we allow any of our children to live in such a vulnerable way where they could be victims of violence, I think that's similar. The similar challenge to the adults in both communities of, are we going to step in and do something, or are we going to let this happen? I think we see in both places, even if the circumstances are different.
We're talking to Madeline Philbin, who is the Executive Director for the Midwest Region of Catholic Relief Services. We'll be right back. We're now back with Madeline Philbin of the Catholic Relief Services. I almost gave you a new name there. You were to Uganda. You saw the results. You saw how there was an attempt to ameliorate things, to protect these kids, and the kids were protecting themselves. How did that change you? Did it? How did it affect you?
You know, I have many nieces and nephews, with three brothers and three sisters. I have 13 nieces and nephews. And, you know, yeah, I couldn't help but see these kids come in and picture my nieces and nephews. I would see children coming in as young as age 3 on the back of a sibling. And to just have it, this reality, we might know intellectually this is happening, but you just have a moment where it's an undeniable reality that children are experiencing this. You asked me a little bit earlier in the program if my work had sort of changed my ideas about people at all. And, you know, one thing I would say that I can't deny with the work that I've now done and seen with Catholic Relief Services is the amount of suffering, or you could say the amount of evil there is in the world. I mean, there are children that are at risk of becoming soldiers and living the life that you describe, that's a reality. Yeah, that was just, you know, that's a shocker that does change you.
I tell you, I spent, as my audience knows, I spent a number of years in a seminary studying to be a priest. And during that time, we learned, you know, all the different 10 years worth of the different ways that people can commit sins and, you know, offend against a moral or an ethical creed. I learned more as in my first 3 weeks in the prosecutor's office in Berrien County about the reality of antisocial behavior, to put it nicely, crimes, brutality, picking on the weak, than I ever learned, or at least that I ever appreciated when I read all those books with the catalogs of this and that. And so I will tell you that it did affect me. I mean, it brought evil, and no one can sit here and say that the Holocaust is not a sign of absolute evil stalking around. And the same thing on a smaller scale that I find in communities and in individuals and in families. I mean, I remember sitting across the table, standing actually, to be quite precise, from a fellow who had killed a six-year-old boy because he was doing it help that boy's father collect $1,500 in insurance money. And because he couldn't get that little six-year-old away from that kid's mother, he decided he had to kill her as well, which he did. He just executed the two of them together. And he described it with less emotion than I'm giving you right now. And I looked at him, and when I heard him describing how he killed these two people and another woman as well for insurance, I saw, not to put too fine a point to it, evil. And this fellow looked at me, and he realized I was reacting, and he said to me, "Don't you look at me like that. You made me what I am." I said, "I did? I don't even know you." He said, "Well, your prison system made me what I am." Well, I'm not so sure that the prison system didn't have a head start, or his life didn't have a head start in the prison system. But the point is, regardless of the reason, regardless if it's jealousy between the Hutus and the Tutsis, whether it's problems that kids in the ghetto in Chicago have, whatever, or you come from Oak Park. I mean, gangs are in Oak Park. Gangs are in, there is crime in lots of different places. And it strikes me that people don't often come in contact with this in their ordinary life, maybe because you see it the hardest part of life, the starvation of kids or the young kids being brought in as soldiers and whatnot. And I saw it as a prosecutor. Maybe we see it more graphically and more often, but I think it's a reality in this world. Evil is not evil in the form of these things that you've been talking about are they've affected me. I don't know.
You know, one of the things that I do in my job and my work is to go tell the story of what I see in different parts of the world, what Catholic Relief Services does. And part of the idea is that once you hear the story, you say, how am I going to live my life differently? You know, how am I going to live my life differently? Certainly once we've seen what we've seen, but even when your listeners hear what they hear, you know, how do I live my life differently? And what is the connection between the choices that I'm making and the circumstances of folks around the world? And so, you know, one of the things is something like this makes us uncomfortable. And so we want to, if you're uncomfortable, you know, if you're in an uncomfortable position, you shift your position so you're not uncomfortable. So if we're uncomfortable, we have a couple of choices. And one is to shift and not look and look away and not pay attention anymore. And that's, I guess, the first step is just to challenge ourselves not to do that, you know, not to turn our gaze away. And then,
makes awfully uncomfortable. Yeah. You're making people awfully uncomfortable.
You know, we're approaching the Easter season, and we all, those of us who are, you know, participating in the Passion and the celebration on Easter, we hear the story of those who did not leave the foot of the cross, you know, who stayed with Christ through those final hours and did not turn away. And so, you know, I'm guessing they felt useless. I can't fix this problem. I can't solve it. But they also didn't abandon this person who was suffering because they couldn't solve the problem in that moment. So I think the first thing is not to turn away. And then if you're really listening and you're open to it and you can bring this into your prayer life, and if you say, I'm going to educate myself, I'm going to start reading the articles in the newspaper that usually I skip over, I'm going to start by reading the headline, and then I'm going to read the first sentence, and next month I'm going to read the first paragraph, and just become more aware of what's really in front of us in this world, I think each of us will see opportunities of ways we can change our own lives, our own spending habits, our own storytelling. You know, folks who are listening to us today, to just go and tell someone else, you know, I heard this incredibly powerful story and I want to tell you about it. And just be part of the community that's telling the story of those who are living in poverty and who are suffering, and how we can contribute to making a better life for them or helping them make a better life for themselves.
And then what's the next step? Or is there a next step?
There's a next step. I think once you kind of are open to this, you'll start noticing what some of those next steps are is, you know, what is the connection between choices I'm making here and how people are living overseas? What is the connection between our choices we're making as a nation in terms of our foreign policy? Do I ever talk to my congressman or senator about what U.S. policy is in terms of how it affects children in Uganda or the Congo or Haiti? You know, most of us would feel comfortable if we needed to talk to our congressman or senator about a housing issue in our own neighborhood, but we'd feel like, well, how can I talk to them about world hunger? And yet we, Catholic Relief Services, often talk to congressmen and senators, and we tell them the stories of what we see and what we think will help. And often they say to us, gee, I wish more of my constituents were talking to me about this, because I don't know what they're thinking, and I'm glad to hear what you're thinking. So one is just to invite people to start to pay attention to this. We have a campaign, if you will, an initiative that's called Catholics Confront Global Poverty. And certainly any person of goodwill could go on the web and go to this Catholics Confront Global Poverty, and you say, well, how do you begin to confront global poverty? Well, poverty is usually related to hunger, it's related to disease, and it's related to conflict. So we break poverty into those three things, and then we say, well, what kind of policies do we have that have an impact on disease around the world, or hunger, or conflict? And then you can, you know, we can keep breaking it down from there. But things like climate change, legislation, I mentioned that to a friend who said, oh, I didn't know you worked on domestic issues. And then he kind of paused and goes, oh, yeah, climate. I guess it's not just a domestic issue, or issues related to migration and immigration, or related to foreign assistance. I mean, those are all ways, by becoming involved in legislative advocacy, that you can actually help folks suffering with these circumstances around the world. You can also contribute to an organization like Catholic Relief Services or some of the others you were mentioning at the top of the program. So sometimes giving money is the best way, or the strongest way you have of showing solidarity with an organization and that you want to change things. What's being taught at your kid's school? Are they learning about what's going on in Central Africa? I mean, how are you spending your money? And when you buy chocolate, do you think about, is there child labor involved in this or not?
No, don't hit me on chocolate. Oh, don't. No.
So you can purchase fairly traded chocolate. There you go. If you buy fair trade chocolate, you know you're buying a product where children are not exploited. So you begin, you know, you can start with one thing, and I think as you're open to it, you'll start to notice there are things all around that are suggesting ways you could be living your life differently that's going to be better for all of us.
You know, your words are fascinating, because I remember, again, I'm a recovering politician here, and I ran for office, and the first time I ran for office on a statewide level, I had to raise money, and my campaign manager said, all right, you've got to start calling people and asking for money. I said, I can't do that. What do you mean you can't do that? I said, you want to pay for this? I know your bank account. You can't pay for this race. And I said, but it's too hard. Mm-hmm. And so she said, okay, here's a phone. Call up. This is a person. Just call them up. And so I remember dialing the phone. I said, hi, this is John Smetank. I'm running for attorney general, and I'd sure like your support. And the fellow said, great, great, happy to support you. And then I said, and could I have some money? It was the hardest thing in the world I had to do. It was easy to go around and shake people's hands. And because I like people, I love talking to them. I love meeting them, love learning about their issues. And I love telling them who I am. So, you know, I hope you vote for me, but whatever, here's who I am. But asking them for money was something that went against everything that I was raised with. And by that I mean, and I've seen this in politicians. I've only met two politicians in my life. I've seen thousands of them who actually liked raising money. There's two of them. Hmm. I won't even mention who they were, but they just ate it up. But I think what it is, if I can extrapolate for a minute, is that often the people who get into politics, and maybe in other, I'm certainly in other parts of life, are raised by their families to be on their own and to be responsible and to say, basically, you don't ask for anything from anybody, you do it on your own. And this may surprise people who think that all politicians are just looking for a place to retire and on the public trough. But most of them were raised just with what I said. Get out there and do it on your own. And so therefore, they were taught, my parents taught me, never ask for anything. Mm-hmm. Do it yourself. You know, you have an obligation to contribute back to the society, not to take from it. So at any rate, I had to learn, and this is what my campaign manager said, John, many of the people that you're going to be talking to want to contribute to this society somehow. They may not have the time or be in the position of life or frankly have the guts to run for political office, but this is their way. Giving some money is their way of making a contribution back to their society. And I think, and that all of a sudden made it a little bit easier for me, because she was saying, well, you're giving them the opportunity to do what they really want to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a great deal of truth to that, which we're going to talk about in just a minute. We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Madeline Philbin about giving, about poverty, about organizational efforts to deal with the problems of the world. We'll be right back. We're now back with Madeline Philbin, who is the Executive Director for Catholic Relief Services here in the Midwest, but has had experiences around the world. So, Madeline, besides raising money, which I'm sure is a part of your responsibility, and also making people aware of these kinds of problems you've been talking about, what do you do? What do you do besides with your fun? Mm-hmm. I mean, what other things do you do?
Well, I'm going to just add something to your to your opening. I was talking a little bit before about the path that Catholic Relief Services has been on since the end of the Second World War, from relief to development to peace building. And somewhere, I would say, around the year 2000 is when we realized that we do this in the name of the American Catholic, and we're supported not only by American Catholics, but by Americans. And we realized we were on this incredible journey where we had gone from relief to development to peace building. And we say we're in the name of the American, but we haven't taken them on the journey with us. And that was really where this idea of solidarity became part of the organization as well. And actually, we changed our actual mission statement. So it talks not only about responding to the poor and vulnerable overseas, but to serving the American church here in the U.S. and helping them to live their faith in solidarity with the poor and vulnerable. So actually, my job doesn't even, fundraising isn't even part of my job. My job is really that part of our mission, which just says, how can we serve folks here and help them to really live their lives in solidarity with the people we work with around the world? And so our team of staff that's in the Midwest office, we try to connect with institutions here in the Midwest, so it may be schools or colleges or dioceses, and tell the story. And some of the kinds of conversation we've been talking about tonight is how do you connect, and what do you do now that you've heard the story? So our colleagues come from all over the world. You met Thomas, who came from Ghana. So one of the kind of perks, you could say, of the job too is that we have this great sort of off-duty time of having someone from Ghana or from Afghanistan or from coming to us from Guatemala, from any of the places we work with around the world, who come to visit the Midwest. And so I also get to be tour guide and tell them a little bit about the history and show them around and just answer their questions about American culture. So we end up having this other function of, I don't know how many of them will say, well, they're going back to their home country with this perhaps different idea of Americans, but certainly a wonderful awareness of just the generosity of folks here and also how interested they are in learning about their lives in other parts of the world, which they might not have known about if they hadn't had a chance to get a good Midwest welcome.
How about the other way around, though? Do you... I know that you and your other colleagues will be going periodically to other countries for whatever reason.
Right.
But do the people that you who live here ever have the opportunity to see what you do overseas?
Right. We do take people who live here overseas. We don't have any kind of volunteer program, and that's something that people ask us about, and we look at from time to time, and it's just... It's not something that you can sort of casually do. We work, as I've said, in some of the poorest places in the world in really hardship circumstances. So we could not lightly say, oh, yeah, sure, you know, come on in and volunteer. But what we do is have delegations visit maybe for 10 days or 2 weeks at a time. We'll take a group of university presidents or folks who work in the peace and justice offices at their diocese or high school teachers, and that really this is an opportunity for them to learn more about the issues. It's not so much learning more about Catholic Relief Services, to be honest. It's more about learning about the lives of the people that we work with and the issues that they live with so that they can be witnesses back here. And we try to do that whenever we can.
And then you hit them up for money?
I don't know, those Catholic school teachers, they don't have a lot of spare change.
But. Well, I mean, that is a point. And the point I'm trying to make with some humor is there's got to be a result of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've already talked about the result of the change in results that you've aimed for in the organization's history.
Right.
From relief to development to peace to education.
Right.
All right. Now, it's a two-way street. Education is a two-way street. So I wasn't being totally facetious about this. That is there not a value to the pure education of people here, of some, I don't want to say substance, because I'm not even talking substance, that have the ability to affect others. I always thought, for example, that the greatest experience that I had in my life, in my educational life, was when I went to England and studied. I studied to be a barrister in London. And up to that point, I had never been out of the United States, save for Canada and Mexico and the Caribbean. But I'd never been to Europe. And I was struck, it was a like thunderstruck, at this whole new world out there. Now, that was a Western world where, sure, there's poverty, but it's has a long history, that it's a part of my history, and so on. But it was a great education, and it changed my way of doing things back here in the United States. Mm-hmm. I took ideas from my experiences in London and came back and made changes in the office of prosecutor that were based upon that, and I think for the better. That seems to me to be something which should be a part of a mission statement of every organization that deals with the world outside of the United States. Mm-hmm. It's a mutual educational process.
Absolutely. It's a mutually transforming relationship. Right. You know, what we're doing here. Well, as we work with folks on issues overseas, if you tug on most of those issues, you know, the string is going to connect back to the United States in some way. I mean, the whole world is interconnected. We saw that certainly with the crash of the economy, just how interconnected we all are. It's an interdependent world, and we're inviting people to really think about that and live their life with that awareness, to live in solidarity, to talk about a Catholic social teaching principle. So what, you know, we do have a vision or results we'd like to see as folks become more aware. We'd like, as a consumer, when you spend money, to think there's a person behind everything I buy. It's a relationship with the person who produced that product or made that food. So am I choosing to spend my money in a way that I think is going to help the person who produced the product, just to become more aware in actions like that? In terms of schools, how are our high schools introducing students to the whole idea of living in solidarity, with an awareness of how their choices here affect people overseas? We'd love to have all our, you're talking about being in the seminary, we have a program where we take seminarians over to see Catholic
ex-seminarians.
That's right. But how are we, you know, as we form our clergy, as we educate them, to have part of that clergy education be this reflecting on global solidarity and what does it mean and how do you live your life? So we'd really like to see the institutions and the ministries not just take a trip and come back and say, gee, that was interesting, but really say, how do I change my institution now?
But it's not necessary, is it, that the motivation to do the things that Catholic Relief Services does has to be religious? That is, it may be in your situation, mm-hmm. in your organization situation, to have its roots in a particular creed, but it's not, you know, it's not just a Catholic thing.
Right.
Giving, developing, peace. Do you see that other organizations have that same kind of zeitgeist that you've just described?
You know, I think it's true that there are other organizations where you're, you know, part of the motivation for why they do the work they do is this sense of the basic good there is in people, and the desire to want to make lives better for the folks, their neighbors, whether their neighbors are on the other side of the world or are living here. You know, I mentioned before that the majority of our staff around the world are Muslim, for example. And one of them, and it's very consistent with their faith to work for a faith-based organization, even though it's a different one. You know, one of my colleagues in Pakistan said, I'm a better Muslim for working for Catholic Relief Services. You know, mm-hmm. it strengthens my own experience. Again, working in South Asia, I have a colleague who talked about when Pope John Paul II died a few years ago, how the community came to the Catholic Relief Services office and offered their condolences. So he said, so there's no, they get that we're Catholic, they get that identity, but then there's this sort of working together in this sense of a common faith. But you're right, it doesn't, your call to action does not even necessarily have to be faith-based. It's but a sense to want to be contributing mm-hmm. to something good in the world. You know, one of the, again, what do you see and learn about people as you work over time is, is we see people supporting the work of Catholic Relief Services who have just about every political view, right, left, up, down, in between, that you could think, how would you ever get these people to agree on anything, right? Especially today. But the idea of doing something about global poverty, about doing something about world hunger, it's not a right issue or a left issue. It's really just something people are called to do out of their sense of humanity.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time. We could continue this forever. I find it extremely interesting. But I've got to ask you one question. On a personal level, all right, you've been doing this for all of your adult life, right? What else would you like to do? Would you like to have been a baseball player, an opera singer, something else? What would be, if you had to choose an alternative way of spending your life, what would it have been?
What a fun question. I think I would be a studio artist, an artist.
All right. Do you paint?
A paint.
All right.
Draw.
Excellent. Next time you have a collection, come on out here. We have many art galleries that we can display your work. We've been talking to Madeline Philbin, who is the executive director for the Midwest region of the Catholic Relief Services, talking about the vast problems around the world and the attempt of one organization and the individuals and herself who've been working in it to make a difference. The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. Until next week, remember, if you show respect, respect will be shown to you.